You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
And shooting people who didn't do what they were told.
Welcome to Cold War Conversations.
If attack is imminent, you will hear the attack sound like this. If the fallout warning sounds are heard, they will be like these. Buy food well wrapped or in tins. By the way, don't forget your tin opener and bottle opener.
Regional Seats of Government, or RSGs, were a UK solution to disperse the machinery of government into the provinces, where there would be a greater chance of survival after a nuclear attack. Today, we speak to Andrew, who was assigned a role in an RSG, and details his experiences on a week-long training course at the Civil Defence College at Easingwold in Yorkshire during the 1980s. There's some chilling details of the scenarios they had to prepare for. Now, if you're enjoying your weekly dose of Cold War Conversations, I'm asking if you could support us for $3 a month to help keep us on the air. That's about 60 pence or 75 US cents per episode, or perhaps a coffee or two a month. Now that's what I call good value. Plus, you'll become the envy of your friends with that sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster too. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't donate financially, then you can also help us by leaving a written review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this podcast, as well as sharing us on social media. Andrew starts with the surprising circumstances of his first notification of his regional seat of government role. We welcome Andrew to our Cold War conversation.
In 1986, I became the district manager for the employment service, looking after the job centres in Leicestershire and Northamptonshire. I was based in the district office in Charles Street in Leicester, and I can't remember precisely, but probably I started there in October of 86. After sometime in the following year, the regional director said to me, "Your job carries the additional responsibility of being the job centre person in the regional seat of government in East Midlands."
So was that in your job description when you applied for the role, or you were just informed that this was another duty?
It was not in the job description. My predecessor was ex-Royal Engineers and had some military experience, and I just thought when he left and I took over, I took over the role even though I hadn't served in the armed forces.
Right. So they sent you on this course.
It was a week long course.
What was the actual title of your role in the regional seat of government?
I'm not sure I know even to this day. But it was anything to do with, because it was the job centre service, it was anything to do with labour supply, recruitment, and I think to a lesser extent, any relief or humanitarian effort.
Right.
But it was what was said to me was pretty well limited to, you know, you're in the business of managing recruitment and services. So that'll be your post in this regional seat of government.
Right.
That proved not to be the case.
Right. So how did you get to Easingwold? Was it train, car?
As far as I can remember, I took an official car.
Right. Right.
So arrived Monday morning and left Friday afternoon.
Okay.
And it was probably winter, although I can't recall exactly.
Yeah.
One significant thing about this is that every other course I've been on with Her Majesty's Government, you came away with reams of paperwork.
Mm.
There was no paperwork at all from this course. There was probably a letter that I had to take to get there and get to lodge and to book in.
Mm.
But there was no other paperwork to say this is what you've learnt or this
right.
is what you should have learnt.
Right, right. So what was the content of the course? I mean, this was a one-week course, so presumably it was quite intensive?
It was intensive. It was in, probably classically, it was in two parts. The first part, the first couple of days, were lectures by scientists, probably people from the scientific civil service, about nuclear war, the atomic bomb, you know, what happens when it's dropped, what happens to buildings, what happens to people. So the first day or two, the attendees and I were in sort of receiving information. That moved very quickly into, I think, what would now be called role play.
Right.
I don't think it was called role play at the time. But we were in a room where we could receive television programs and radio broadcasts, and from that point on played out various scenarios that War was imminent. The Russians were invading West Germany. The British Army had responded by battlefield thermonuclear weapons, and then the Russians had launched an all-out nuclear attack on Great Britain.
Right, so these were like dummy news programme, TV programmes.
They didn't feel... I wouldn't have used the word dummy.
Yeah.
They didn't feel like that. It was very absorbing, yeah. I would say. You could sort of think, well, this isn't really going on because I'm in a strange room in a strange building in North Yorkshire,
yeah.
and this is just a drama, but in fairness to the course, it didn't come along like that. It was like a sort of condensed, what might have been several weeks' news, condensed into a number of hours until we got to the point where, as I say, where nuclear war felt like it had become a reality. Right.
And were there known people in these TV broadcasts? I mean, were they using BBC News readers or anything like that?
Not that I can remember. Right. They were probably unknown actors, to the best of my recollection.
Yeah. Okay. And when you say that the first part of the week you had the scientific advisors, I mean, presumably they were talking about the hydrogen bomb as well and the sort of big devastation of that
I don't remember that they probably did.
Yeah.
I just remember that the examples that were drawn from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So it was perhaps not to frighten us too much, I don't remember explicit reference to these, but just, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were pretty tiny bombs, and now we've got great big ones.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki would be classified as tactical.
Yes, yeah. But it was very, in today's jargon, it was very sort of evidence-based. We're not talking about things that might happen or could happen. This is what happened in Japan in 1945, and this is what we would expect to happen to buildings in Leicestershire in 1987.
I'm just surprised that they were, you know, talking in those sort of terms, but I think you're possibly right. They don't want to scare the horses too much by, you know, saying actually the level of devastation is going to be far greater than we're describing.
If it was talked about, that my mind cut it out.
So Because I know that there were these various phases that the civil defence or the local government organisations had to prepare for, which was sort of like the lead up to war, conventional conflict, and then nuclear war. What actions were you expected to take in those different segments?
I'm not sure I remember very. Very clearly. The only thing, one thing I do remember, was the production of a map from, we'll call it Russian intelligence, showing the targets in the United Kingdom.
Right.
So we were sort of expected to prepare for bombs, missile strikes on some of these places, mm-hmm. which could be anywhere the length and breadth of Britain.
Yeah.
But obviously, given that I was, that sense, part of the East Midlands, would be part of the East Midlands team, paid particular attention to the targets in East Midlands, which were the major cities, centres of manufacturing, for example, Rolls-Royce and Derby, and the airfields in Lincolnshire.
Right.
So I think it was just to get us into a state of mind, and I remember another example as well, in a state of mind that it wasn't just the cities that would be targeted, and therefore you could lull yourself to think we'll be safe in the countryside. Mm. So there was a in Lancashire, there's actually a on the west coast, which you think might be away from nuclear fallout. There's actually a Royal Navy radio station, which was marked by the Russians as a prime target.
Right.
So I think that's as to what actually, in practical terms, preparation is supposed to. I have no clear idea.
No, and that's fair enough. I completely accept that. I am asking for impossible levels of detail here. So in this room where you're doing the role play, was there somebody who was basically the regional commissioner and various other people were playing the sort of roles that would be within a regional seat of government?
And as it turned out, yes, there were people from, I'm sure there were people from the military and the emergency services along with the emergency services, the auxiliary, like St John's Ambulance. I'm sure all those people fire. I'm pretty sure the fire service is represented, because I remember the fire service man having to come up with, in terms of preparation, he had to come up with a dispersal plan. Mm-hmm. That the fire vehicles couldn't be left in the city centres. They had to be brought to the edge of towns. Yeah. I sort of remember that. And in terms of individual roles, for some reason, perhaps because they couldn't think of anything else better that I ought to be doing, I ended up sort of as keeping the war diary.
Right.
Or recording what, recording what people were doing,
and like
the fire service chief, dispersing the fire engines, and there were probably similar things for the hospitals and the ambulance service, but I can't remember any specific action.
So you can't remember any more details war diary you were.
It was. This was. At some point, we moved we moved from being given the talks to seeing the movement to wall, to being it being an interactive thing where we were receiving messages from central government. I don't remember messages coming the other way, so receiving messages from central government about what we were supposed to do.
Right.
So I suppose basically I was writing those down. And then probably passing the messages were then passed on to the emergency services and the local authorities. Because I remember one, I think in retrospect, one very bizarre set of dialogues about Hinckley in Leicestershire, where a large number of Asians had been killed, Hindu Asians, and the scenario was that these were being buried in mass graves, but the Hindu leaders had asked for them to be burned. It's slightly ironic.
Yeah. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Yeah.
Scenario here.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they probably were burnt anyway. But yeah. Came within my sort of field of responsibility, and what was I going to do about this? And the short answer, or even the long answer, was, well, nothing. You know, I mean, we were very sorry, but it was all we could do was to put the bodies in a big hole in the ground.
Yeah.
We weren't able to. But for some reason, that dialogue communication fell to me.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's one episode I remember. Yeah. So,
well, essentially, I guess the argument would be is our labour force is limited; it's got other priorities, and this isn't one of them. I suppose.
Yeah, well, I think that's sort of post-event justification. Yeah.
Obviously, you being in charge of the employment aspect, I mean, you were presumably said, well, there's X percent of casualties, and therefore, did you have to then devise how you were going to divide up the available labour force to deal with the post-attack?
I would say probably, although I don't remember doing that. But there was, as with any government activity, there was a lot of data flowing in and out, and central government wanting data. I think central government wanting data, which was collated from the police and emergency services, and about casualties and dead and casualties in hospital and what the consequences of those were, as I've said.
Yeah, and I mean, it was interesting you commenting about the Hindu scenario there. Were there other scenarios that were introduced, like, I don't know, peace protesters or anything like that you can recall?
I can't recall any. I just think it was because Leicester was the home to a considerable number of Asian people.
Yeah.
And I, as the district manager, worked pretty well all the time with Asian communities.
Yeah.
Then it was sort of testing out that scenario.
Yes.
With me. Because, like, I was the, in inverted commas, the expert on what's now called diversity.
And I did other real things
with the community.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Particularly in the wake of the civil disturbances.
Yeah.
So I think it was just it was a bit of sort of typecasting.
Yes.
And maybe other people with different roles were the scenario was tested with them.
And during this training course, were there anything that sort of stands out where you just thought, my goodness, I hadn't even thought that I'd have to deal with that, or anything that sort of stands out aside from the examples you've already given me?
I think without being glib, or perhaps just being unimaginative, then not really.
Right.
I mean, I think the other thing that stands out, which is where we started our introduction, was the visit to the regional seat of government in York.
Right.
Which in some ways made it more real than the mock television broadcasts.
Yes.
And the interactive radio dialogue.
Right. And that was part of the course, wasn't
it? That was part of the course. We were allowed, and I think it was probably the last afternoon, the Thursday afternoon. Yeah, we were allowed sort of time out of the hothouse.
Yes.
To go and see where we would have been working should nuclear war have occurred.
And what was that visit like?
It was pretty stone cold sobering.
Can you just take me through how that visit worked?
Well, we probably got on a bus, we got on a coach, and we got off outside the regional seat of government, and this is the regional seat of government, and not many people are allowed in here, and don't tell anybody you've been in.
Right.
And you go through, you know, there's a lot of concrete. I mean, I think somebody said to me later, it is partially above ground, but there's a lot of concrete here, and you go through these steel doors, and you go through anonymous corridors that are straight out of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And you do feel, I mean, I'm slightly prone to claustrophobia anyway, which is not exactly ideal for being in a regional seat of government.
No, I would have thought they would have asked that pretty early on, to be honest.
They didn't. And I asked them, when I was in there, or afterwards, I asked them that, is there any psychometric testing?
Yeah.
For people, and they just said, no, it's pay and rations.
Yeah.
You know, you're nominated to do it. It's very British. You're nominated to do it.
Yeah.
So you can do it. So I didn't pursue it, but I felt there was no need. So, yeah, so you go further down these anonymous tunnels, well, anonymous corridors, but you know the tunnels because they're underground. And then you go into various rooms, and I remember the BBC studio with the radio. They said the regional commissioner can broadcast from here, and then you go into. Then they showed you the accommodation, which is pretty basic, as I recall, and not very enticing, and then there's the sort of the office, and it's like I described it as an upside down government office.
Right.
Instead of it going upwards, it went downwards. But it was all the usual government furniture, furnishings.
Yeah.
And this is your desk, you know, your desk chair. An in tray and an out tray, and I was quite, I don't know, whether flippant or you might call it, you know, I thought, what, you know, you're in a nuclear bunker, why on earth do you need an in tray and an out tray?
Yeah.
And because I asked a question and I got a sort of straightforward answer. You know, it's, well, you're there to deal with problems. Messages will come into you.
Yeah.
You will write the answers.
Yeah.
Or ring up. I mean, it's a pretty, in fairness, it's a pretty sophisticated telecoms and communication system down there. So you will compose the answer and you'll send it, you'll either get it transmitted over telex, or you'll ring somebody up, and I think at that point I sort of stopped questioning.
Yeah, yeah. And York was the RSG that you would have been sent to?
No. The RSG in East Midlands, I think, was in Loughborough.
Right, okay. So they were just showing you an example one that was near to Easy World.
But they said they're all like this.
Right. Yeah. Have you visited one of the preserved ones?
No.
Since?
No, I haven't.
I will have to take you to Hack Green at Nantwich.
Right, fine. Yeah.
It would be really interesting to walk round with you.
Yeah, well, we can do a sort of follow up on the sort of outside broadcast. Yeah.
They'd be delighted to see you there as well, because it would really sort of bring the place alive. Yeah. But anyway, I digress slightly there. You know, you take around the RSG, and this sounds like this is the last part of the course.
Yes, yeah. I think there was a sort of, probably the Friday morning, there was a sort of a summing up, and you fairly, perhaps an evaluation, in which case I've probably said similar things that I've said to you. Yeah, the television broadcasts were very realistic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, seeing the RSG was, I would put as an essential part of the course.
Yeah.
So those were the two.
Yeah.
Those were the two bits that I would sort of give ticks to, and some of the other was filling. And I think that later in my career, I did quite a lot of management training. Mm. I mean, if I'd been running the course, I think I would have had a slightly different approach to the psychology of it. Because I think you picked up one flaw, perhaps, was that you were working with people you'd never met before, and you were never going to meet again. Whereas, as the Job Centre Service matured, we put a lot of emphasis on team working, and you could actually run a course with the people who would make the team in any given region.
Yes.
So it did. So the truth with that, it did feel a bit sort of tick box. So we can say, you know, Andrew's been on the course now, but how he interacted with, you know, his fellow officials or commissioners is just an unknown quantity.
Yeah. So presumably you were staying on site during this course
as
well.
Yes, it was a residential course, fairly standard at the time, originating way back, but my comparisons were predominantly with the Civil Service College, where you went to Sunningdale, where the college was, for a week or fortnight's course. You stayed on site.
So did you socialise with your other attendees evenings?
I suppose I must have done, but they don't leave any impression on me, I'm afraid.
That's a shame, because when it's question, I was just intrigued, what did you, you know,
what did
you
we talk about
the
at night?
And
I'm really, really, really pushing you on this. I suppose in a backhanded way of answering it, we didn't sort of break out and go to the pub, which was usually on residential courses, would have been the norm, to be honest. You wouldn't have stayed on site all four, at least I very rarely have, on residential courses.
Now you know, we're getting to the truth.
That's
Andrew.
It, yeah, yeah. But I don't remember whether it was discouraged or we were apathetic, socially apathetic. I don't know.
Do you think it was because the content was so sobering that you each to their own thoughts on it?
And no, I think we were just lazy.
Right, oh, okay.
Socially
it
lazy.
It was apathy rather than...
Yeah, no. It would be... Yeah, no, there isn't... It's a different glib answer, if I may. The only thing, we had meals on site... And I did remember, because We were each allocated our own napkin, our own piece of cloth, fabric napkin.
Yes.
And it went in especially, they all went in specially numbered set of pigeonholes.
Right.
So you know, if your napkin was in pigeonhole number 14,
yeah,
then you had to take it from there before the meal and return it there after the meal.
And what do you think was behind that?
Apart from some sort of autism, I'm not sure. I felt it was very regimented.
Yeah.
I mean, I said at the outset, I was selected in spite of my lack of military experience. But I have done, I think before then, I had done work with the Army and with the Air Force. And it reminded, with the Air Force, you stayed on station. And it just reminded me of,
yeah,
like my visits work with the Air Force and, yeah, the armed services, and I think it was a somewhat strange way of trying to instill a sense of discipline into some people who may not have any sense of discipline.
Yes.
Or may have too great a sense of anarchy.
Yeah.
No, because I was never asked. Was I about the, mentioned about the claustrophobia?
Yeah.
I was never asked about, you know, did I support CND, which seemed a really, which
obvious
seemed
question.
An obvious question. You know, I could have got in the bunker and said, "Oh, this is all a waste of time. Let's just open the doors."
Yeah.
And anybody, you know, will go outside and die with the rest of them, which I think would have been a sort of CND approach.
Yeah.
So it was never.
So you were never asked, are you a member of the Communist Party or, you know...
Like, well, not at that stage. I mean, when I was recruited, there was a fairly high level of security. But I suppose that was a practical assessment. But what was missing here was an assessment of your emotions.
Yes, yeah.
So if you'd been a member of CND, then... Oh, I'll rephrase that. Anybody who had been a member of CND would have a different set of emotions than somebody who'd served in the Royal Air Force.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, you're talking about, you know, sort of like psychological assessment and emotional, you know, assessment as well. And I interviewed a guy who served on Polaris nuclear submarines. And I asked the question, did they ask whether you were claustrophobic? And no, they didn't.
No.
They waited until you were on one of these things to see whether you were able to hack it or not, which I did find really, really surprising. So you said that when you were recruited, i.e. into the employment agency...
Yeah, into the civil service,
Into the civil service, was that Official Secrets Act and all of those bits and pieces as well?
Okay. Yeah, but that was 20 years... That was 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
A lot had happened in politics before then. Since then. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't a supporter of CND. I think otherwise I might have been even more schizophrenic the episode, the experience.
Yeah. So the closing moments of the course, they don't give you any paperwork. They just say, right, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't call us, we'll call you.
That's it. Yeah. You'll get a letter. I remember, a letter, not a telegram, or a letter will arrive.
Yeah.
With your instructions,
right.
To which I somewhat flippantly added, get on your bicycle and cycle to the nearest RSG.
Yeah. Because, I mean, the theory was there would be a transition to war. It wouldn't be in a bolt from the blue attack. It would be there would be some level of build up so that they would know to inform you by post, hopefully first class rather than second.
Yeah, but I remember great faith in the Royal Mail to send a letter, you know, report RSG immediately.
Yeah. So as you drive away in your official car, what can you remember what your thoughts were about what you went through?
I think, yeah, I mean, it was a sort of differing experiences. Some of it was, as I said, was, you know, it was fascinating to go inside the regional seat of government. And for somebody like me who likes collecting experiences, I appreciated that. The conduct and presentation of parts of the course were excellent. They went through a lot of trouble to create this scenario leading up to war, and then continue the dialogue in real time. You were getting messages in real time. You're supposed to respond in real time. So that was on the one hand. On the other hand, it was quite surreal, and I just thought, you know, Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Yeah, yeah.
This can't be real, you know.
Yeah.
In some ways, I didn't accept the evidence of my own eyes.
Right. If you'd received the letter, what do you think you would have done?
I don't know at the time. If I received it now, I would pretend I never received it.
Yeah, lost in the post.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole thing is, I know it's less likely now, far less likely now, but the whole thing was so, I suppose we did, going back to your earlier question about did we have any off-piste conversation, we did, yes, probably. So we sat down at night probably and had a pint or two, and I think the unofficial outcome was, if nuclear war's going to occur, just get in a plastic bag and tie yourself up and stay there so you don't, you know, litter the planet.
Yeah, yeah, or stay with your family rather than leave them out there.
Yes.
Did they give any indication how long you might have to stay in that RSG?
Not that I can remember, no.
Okay.
And they probably told you something, you know, that we got enough food and water and fuel for 2 weeks or 4 weeks. But I think I just found that under disbelief.
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. So after you complete this course, you don't participate in any drills or rehearsals or anything?
No.
That's it
until I met you.
Wow.
It's just all... Yeah. It's still all filed away. I did... You know, just to sort of exonerate myself a little bit, when I retired, I brought a lot of papers with me, some of which I kept, most of which I've thrown away, but I've been back over those, and there's no written record of anything. Well, there's a written record of Easing World, isn't there? There's very little. There's no written record of the course,
yes,
as opposed to the bricks and mortar or concrete and steel.
Yeah, it's really interesting, you know, you saying about, you know, not receiving any paperwork at the end of the course. So it was, you know, and because you know from your managerial experiences, training is only good if you actually then use those skills on a regular basis. Otherwise they just, just all fades away.
Yeah.
But obviously some of that you can recall, you know, the...
Yes, and I have, in fairness to everybody, I think, Yes, I have sort of drawn on it at other times in the past, and almost into the present now, because where I live now in South Wales, we're prone to flooding, and they set up a flood group, and I offered to be on it because of the emergency training that I'd had. So nothing is totally wasted, so that isn't totally wasted.
Well, no, and I think you're right, because I think some of this training then evolved into the emergency planning training, and some of these headquarters continued to be used in later years for, you know, natural disasters.
Yeah. That's what we're still doing, continuing locally.
It's really interesting, you know, what you were describing there, because I think that the other thing is describing the technology at the time as well, because, you know, obviously there was no internet. It was either telephone or runner, messenger, you know, somebody physically passing.
Yeah, telex we had,
And fax to some degree.
Yeah, I can't remember if it's fax or telex, but... And as I say, the other thing I thought was quite sophisticated was the broadcast studio.
Yes.
There was a lot of, I suppose, in all that I've said, there's a lot in there about how do we control the civil population.
Yeah.
And keeping them informed, whether it's of truth or lies, was an important, you know, there's a lot of it, don't panic.
So that was a key part of the course, was trying to keep the civil population docile.
Stable, acquiescent, no mass migration of people from the towns to the countryside or vice versa, but particularly getting people to stay where they were.
Yeah.
And also managing food supplies as well, I remember now.
Yeah.
And arming, as well as the military, arming the police.
Right.
And shooting people who didn't do what they were told.
Yeah. And how much of that was mentioned in the course?
Probably quite a bit.
Right.
Yeah. Probably quite
so
a bit.
So the imposition of martial law and the shooting of looters.
Yes.
And,
yeah. That was all mentioned. It just sort of wasn't high in my responsibilities.
No. But No, because, I mean, have you seen the film Threads?
I think so, yes. Yeah.
Where, I mean, there's various classic scenes there, but there's one with the traffic warden armed with a rifle. But it's that whole imposition of martial law and the shooting.
Yeah, that was mentioned. That wasn't hidden. That was quite explicit.
Right.
Yeah. Whether I would have shot anybody ever.
Yes.
We weren't asked to do it. We were just told to
tell somebody else to do it.
Yeah. But I think that in some ways that was sort of still felt quite abstract. Still sort of conceptual and not real. Mm. But certainly control of the civil population.
But it's really interesting because that's the sort of or one of the areas which is one of the most, well, aside from a nuclear attack anyway, but the most frightening is that breakdown of society.
Yeah.
And lawlessness and all of that sort of side of things. And it's interesting, you know, just hearing about it was always going to be a balancing act to try and keep the population where you wanted them and keep them, as you said, acquiescent.
Yeah.
Rather than them become, you know, it become anarchy.
Hmm. Yeah, that was definite message that came out.
Yeah. And just other bits coming out, because we didn't touch on martial law and the shooting, and that sort of fired a little memory.
It did.
There,
you're somewhere sitting around that table, writing up the war diary. You know, today we shot some looters.
So can you remember that as being in the war diary?
If you like what you're hearing, sign up to our email list at coldwarconversations.com. And we have further photos, videos and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.